You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The following program is a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.
Hi, this is Roy Shoman, and welcome once again to Salvation is from the Jews, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic faith, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the completion, the fulfillment, the full realization of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. As if you've been following the show for a while, you know that different days the show has different formats. And today, once again, I have the great pleasure of sharing our hour together with a guest. This time the guest is not a Jewish convert to the Catholic Church, but he is a new friend of mine who has written a couple of books, one of which in particular is on a theme that actually intersects both with Judaism and with the Catholic Church, and certainly very much with what's going on in the world today. I'm referring to William Kilpatrick, who taught for many years at Boston College. He's the author of several books about cultural and religious issues, including Psychological Seduction, Why Johnny Can't Tell Right from Wrong, and more recently, Christianity, Islam, and Atheism, The Struggle for the Soul of the West. And that's what I was thinking of centering today's conversation on. But he also wrote very recently a book called Insecurity, which is a novel that is kind of on the same theme of what's going on with Islam, in particular in the West, and Islam's attempt, as the title of his other book says, The Struggle for the Soul of the West, Islam's Struggle for the Soul of the West. So I thought that we might begin with that book. By the way, the Christianity, Islam, and Atheism is published by Ignatius Press, and I very strongly recommend it, having recently reread it. It's a really masterful book, and puts together a lot of things. In a funny kind of a way, it reminded me a little bit of my book, Salvation is from the Jews, because it puts together a lot of things that on the surface may seem disparate, but in fact are woven together into one coherent story within salvation history. And the book Insecurity, I know, is available through Amazon.com, either as a printed book or as a Kindle download. So with that introduction, I would like to welcome, may I call you Kirk for the show?
Oh, sure.
Great. So what inspired you, let's start kind of backwards, but, you know, what inspired you to write Insecurity, and what's it about, and why why is it important that we open our eyes to what it's about?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. Appreciate the opportunity. Well, Insecurity I wrote as sort of comic relief from the fictional, the nonfiction stuff I write about Islam, because it's rather a grim subject, and once in a while it helps to take a comic look at it. And basically, Insecurity is a what you might call a dark comedy or a black comedy about political correctness run amok in the military and in the government, to the extent that national security is endangered. It's actually sort of was inspired by the movie Dr. Strangelove, but it sort of reverses the premise of Dr. Strangelove. In that movie, you have a national security, world security, really global security being endangered by a rogue right-wing general, and I reverse the premise and have national security being endangered by liberal, politically correct types in the army and the government who just refuse to look at the evidence in front of their noses. It's about an army captain who is newly assigned to a base, which I call Fort Camp, partly because there's quite a strong element of gay soldiers there and also Muslim soldiers as well. And the Muslim soldiers he discovers have a plot, the Muslim officers, to take over several bases with an eye to a coup which will establish a new Muslim government, Islamic government. And he tries to go to his commanding officer, General Cottle, with this information, but Cottle is so politically correct, he just dismisses this because he believes that religion is, Islam is a religion of peace, and so on. Well, eventually, he makes his way to the Pentagon to divulge what he knows to a General Panzer, Jack Panzer, who he thinks will help him out. But along the way, he encounters all sorts of interesting problems. A rally on the Washington of the National Mall in defense of building a giant grand mosque right in the center of the National Mall with the Washington Monument to serve as its minaret and so forth. Well, anyways, just one of those things that developed out of my regular work, and I found it actually quite a bit easier to write the comedy than to write the nonfiction stuff.
Well, I remember reading you commenting someplace that one of the problems you had writing Insecurity was coming up with situations more absurd than what was really happening.
Well, yes, and in fact, almost everything in the story is based on real-life events. For example, I have a character named Private Stanley Darling, who's a young gay soldier who has a crush on one of the Muslim colonels. And he's so smitten with this Muslim colonel that he's giving him top secret information. And he's sort of modeled on the character, on the real-life character of Private Bradley Manning, who was the main actor behind the WikiLeaks leak of information, the largest leak of classified information in history. His problems were known about for a long time, and that someone like that with so many emotional problems and confusion about gender would be allowed into such a sensitive position as he was in Army intelligence. And so I had a hard time coming up with situations that were any more incredible or bizarre than the ones that are being reported every day with a straight face on the news. Yeah.
Well, when you told that story about Bradley Manning, it reminded me of the Fort Hood shooting and the fact that, what was his name, Major...
Major Hassan.
Hassan. There were lots of red flags, lots of warnings about his erratic behavior before it happened, right?
Oh, sure, and they knew about it. His fellow officers, his commanding officers knew about his jihadist sympathies, but everyone was hesitant to say anything about it or do anything about it because, they could be accused of bigotry or Islamophobia or whatnot, so they chose to remain silent.
And I think that even now that's classified as workplace violence. It's not classified as a terrorist incident.
Well, sure. And as a result, there are a lot of families that aren't receiving the kind of financial aid they should have if it was classified as what it is, a terrorist incident. But that's just more political correctness.
And, of course, the fact that, you know, somebody shouts Allah Akbar before beginning shooting is not evidence at all that it has anything to do with a religious motivation or a terrorist motivation.
Sure, or the fact that he had business cards with the letters SOA stamped on them, meaning Soldier of Allah, or that he used to go around in white robes, or that he gave a PowerPoint presentation to his colleagues about a year before the massacre in which his jihadist sympathies are very, very plain. So the real situation is a dark comedy in itself. Yeah. For example, I just read the other day a headline, Obama lifts ban on Libyans in U.S. flight schools in training in nuke science. So my reaction was, well, what could possibly go wrong?
Right. What's the danger of flight school or nuclear science, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
As a matter of fact, I saw a chilling interview a number of years ago with a gate attendant at the airport in Maine who let on the terrorists who were later that morning to hijack the plane from Boston to fly it into the World Trade Center. Gate attendant said that the guys showed up too late. The gate was already closed to the plane or to the jetway. And he said, "I'm sorry, you won't be able to get on." And they acted so irrationally and got so belligerent and kind of not literally violent, but, you know, went nuts that, he felt this is a really bad situation and he really didn't want to let them on. But he knew that because they were, Middle Easterners, he would get in trouble if he didn't let him on. He would be accused of being racist, so he let him on despite his reservations.
Well, exactly, and there are many other instances of that type of thing. There was a planned attack on Fort Dix by five Muslims a number of years ago, and it was only discovered because they brought in a video that they wanted transferred to a DVD to Best Buy or someplace like that. And the clerk who was looking at the video noticed that it was all about people shooting AK-47s and yelling Allah Akbar. Well, he hesitated to do anything about it for a long time. Finally, he asked his coworker, "Hey, dude, I just saw this weird video. You know, do you think I should do anything about it? I don't want to be thought a racist or anything." So, well, luckily, he let common sense prevail, but that doesn't often happen. Here's an interesting story. About 3 years ago, there was a story in the Washington Post about the head of the CIA Counterterrorism Center in Washington, who had converted to Islam about 6 years previously, which is kind of interesting. But the story just, presents it as kind of a human interest story. Isn't that an interesting thing? And see no possible problem with a recent convert to Islam being the head of the Counterterrorism Center for the CIA. Anyways, multiply that by 100 times, and you've got the situation that we're in today.
Well, I did want to, before going, I don't want to say going on to the next topic, but tying this into the main kind of topic of the show, I read a very chilling piece that you wrote. I forgot to tell our listeners, but you've written these books, but you're also extremely active in writing journal articles and magazine articles and some of the better website journals and, have a lot of stuff in Catholic World Report and Crisis Magazine, frontpage.com, National Catholic Register, and so forth. Note to our listeners that the preponderance of those outlets are in fact Catholic, because you're coming at this from a very Catholic perspective and with a lot of concern about the Church's both the relationship between Islam and the Church from the point of view of whatever threat it poses to the Church, and also the relationship between Islam and the Church from the point of view of what the Church's response to Islam is and what it should be. Anyway, so maybe that's leading me into the next kind of direction, which is what does this have to do, everything we've been talking about, what's it got to do with Islam, and what's it got to do with the danger that Christianity in both, of course, in the Middle East and in the West may be facing?
Well, of course, as you know, nothing has anything to do with Islam, but as you're aware, prime ministers and presidents and even prelates are in the habit of discounting every Islamic terrorist incident as having nothing to do with Islam, but I think one has to be wearing blinders not to notice that there definitely is some connection.
And, well, what would Muhammad do? I mean, everyone says, what would Jesus do? And use, a good Christian models his behavior over what Jesus would do. And presumably a good Muslim models his behavior after what Muhammad would do. So is this stuff faithful to the model of Muhammad?
Well, I'm afraid it is. If Western apologists for Islam often cast these terrorists as misunderstanders of Islam. But if that's so, then Muhammad would have been the first misunderstander of Islam, because the things that he did are the things that are being done today by groups like ISIS and Hamas and so forth. For example, he once ordered the beheading of 700 men of the Quraza tribe, a Jewish tribe in Medina, after they had surrendered and were completely at his mercy. And he ordered that the women and children of the tribe be sold into slavery. So Muhammad was basically a warlord who was a part-time preacher and a part-time prophet. But if you look at Ibn Ishaq's Life of Muhammad, the first biography that was written, at least half the book is dedicated to battles and raids and wars and so forth. That was his main preoccupation. And so not only do the actions of ISIS mirror and echo the actions of Muhammad, but it's all there in the Quran. There's warrant and justification for beheadings, for sex slavery, and so on and so forth, for demanding the jizya payment from Christians and Jews. So the notion that the Islamic State has nothing to do with Islam is not only a stretch, it's just completely false.
So it actually is in some sense, faithfully modeled on the model of Islam that Muhammad himself presented, both in his preaching and in his life history.
Yeah, and they take pains. For example, the most recent statement of the Islamic State, or ISIS as it's sometimes called, or ISIL as the president likes to call it, most recent statement backs up everything they say with extensive quotations from the Quran. One thing about terrorists is that they seem to be quite familiar with the Quran, far from being misunderstanders. Nidal Hassan is an example. He was able to quote copiously from the Quran when he presented this PowerPoint presentation. Umar Abdul-Muttalib, the underwear bomber, was referred to as a scholar when he was in high school for his extensive knowledge of Islam, and in college he was head of the Islamic Society at the University of London. So the notion that these people are misinterpreting the Quran and misinterpreting Islam is just not justified. In fact, it's the moderate Muslims who, or the so-called moderate Muslims, who have a hard time justifying their point of view by quoting from the Quran. My impression is that they don't know their Quran or their Hadith or the Sirah, which is the biography of Muhammad. They don't know it nearly as well as the terrorists.
Either don't know it or choose to ignore it.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the people that we call moderate Muslims are people who are sort of like cafeteria Catholics. They tend to pick and choose what they will take seriously, and they do tend to ignore a lot of stuff that's a lot of the teachings and texts of their religion. Or in some cases, people may simply be ignorant. So in a sense, you could say, well, there was once a debate at the Thomas More Institute between Peter Kraft and Robert Spencer about the proposition was the good Muslim is the bad Muslim, or something to that effect. So from our point of view, the good Muslim is the bad Muslim. In other words, the one who, you know, maybe goes to the mosque on Friday, but other than that doesn't pay too much attention. And these are the ones we mistake for devout moderates. They're usually not very devout.
So this is like the Boston Globe lionizing pro-choice Catholics as, you know,
well,
the
exactly.
real Catholics.
That's a very good analogy, I think.
And of course, the pro-choice Catholic does assert rather, you know, self-righteously that they are Catholic and they're being good Catholics, and they're just kind of correcting this temporary misdirection that the Church has had for the last 2,000 years.
Yeah, but on top of that, I think there are Islamic groups here in America, for example, which knowingly are deceptive about this. I mean, they know what's in the Quran and the other Islamic sources, but they pretend that they're not. There are groups like CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, groups like ISNA, ISNA, the Islamic Society of North America, and, well, there are a couple of dozen of these alphabet soup organizations in America, and they're sort of like lobby groups, like civil rights groups and so forth. And unfortunately, these are the groups that our bishops are dialoguing with, and I think unwittingly, unaware of what kind of groups they're dealing with.
Does the word taqiyya mean anything to you?
Well, yeah, it's an Arabic word for deception or deliberate misleading, lying that's acceptable because it's in a greater cause, the furtherance or the spread of Islam, so that under some circumstances you are permitted to lie according to Islamic law. And my guess is that some of this lying may be going on in the halls of dialogue, unknowns to the bishops who perhaps are overly trusting about their Muslim dialogue partners.
Yeah, my understanding is the principle of taqiyya establishes that lying in the cause of the furtherance of Islam is not only permissible, but it's virtuous.
Yes, many things are considered virtuous in Islam that we would consider quite dubious, such as stoning adulterers and death for apostates and amputations for theft. These are all considered to be virtuous acts. And by the way, I mean, I think the majority of Muslims are probably moderates in the sense that most people are moderate and, you know, don't want to get involved in throwing bombs or shooting guns. But as far as their beliefs, I don't know if you can say they're moderates. For example, polls that have been conducted by the Pew Research Organization in Egypt and in Pakistan show that something like 80% of citizens feel that that death for apostates is good, that stoning adulterers is good, and that amputation for theft is perfectly acceptable. So, you know, these, from a Western point of view, are not moderate beliefs. They're very extreme, dangerous beliefs. So anyway, I think we have to be careful about this notion of, you know, who is and who isn't a moderate Muslim.
Well, we usually take a short break about halfway through the show. And so we will do that now and take a momentary break. This is A Salvationist from the Jews on Radio Maria. We're speaking today with William Kilpatrick, who is his recent book is Christianity, Islam, Atheism, and the Struggle for the Soul of the West. He's an expert on this struggle between Christianity and Islam and for the soul of the West. And we've been talking about what this has to do with the us as Christians. And when we come back from the break, I will talk a little bit about what this has to do with the Jews and the difficulties that are facing them now in the Middle East and what connection that might have to do with Islam. So we'll be back on the other side of this break with more with William Kilpatrick. Please come back.
Thank you. flowing through creation, Spirit burning in the skies. Let the hope of your salvation fill our eyes. God of splendor, God of glory, you who light the stars above, all the heavens tell the story of your love.
As you moved upon the waters, as you ride upon the wind, move us all your sons and daughters deep within. As you shape the hills and mountains, form the land and fill the deep, let your hand renew.
Sends the rivers dancing, love that waters all that lives, love that heals and holds and rouses and forgives. You are food for all your creatures, you are hunger in the soul, in your hands the broken hearted are made
You're tuned to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now return to a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.
Hi, welcome back. This is Roy Shoman with Salvation is from the Jews on Radio Maria, the show that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic faith. And we've been talking today with William Kilpatrick, an expert on Islam and Christian-Islam relations. And he's been informing us a little bit about, I guess I could say, the theme of one of his recent books, Christianity, Islam, Atheism, and the Struggle for the Soul of the West. And I want to turn our attention a bit now to what is going on with the, basically, with the struggle between Islam and Jews and Judaism, and the struggle in Israel and the war, or the kind of ongoing war between the Muslim nations and the State of Israel, and what that might have to do with Islam itself and the teachings of Islam. So let me begin I'm giving you kind of an introduction to the topic, Kirk, and you're welcome to backpedal if you don't want to start there, but I want to read a couple of quotes that that I came across recently on this topic. First of all, from the Palestinian Authority Mufti Muhammad Hussein, Palestine in its entirety is a revolution, continuing today until the end of days. The reliable hadith says, the hour of resurrection will not come until you fight the Jews. The Jew will hide behind stones or trees, then the stones or trees will call, O Muslim servant of Allah, there's a Jew behind me, come and kill him. And in a 2011 poll, 73% of Palestinians said that they believe that the Islamic Hadith preaches it is Islamic destiny to kill Jews wherever they are. So does the tension in the Middle East, does the war between the Palestinians and Israel have something to do with Islam itself? Question mark, Kirk?
Well, yeah, I mean, to you and I think that's pretty obvious, but to many people in the media and in Western governments, it's not. They keep trying to position it or frame it as something having to do with land and territory, and if Israel would just concede a little bit more land or a little bit more of this or a little bit more of that or have more peace talks, then it would all work out. But what the Palestinians have in mind is something that goes way beyond that. The quote from the Hadith that you just mentioned about Muslims must fight the Jews until there aren't any more Jews. And once again, this is the problem with people who are basically secular in the media and in government not seeing the religious motivation behind actions. And the attacks on Israel are really basically motivated by religion, by what's in the Quran and other sources. And for a real good rundown on all these sources, a good book is Andrew Bostrom's The Legacy of Islamic Anti-Semitism. It's a very very thick book, and he gives lots and lots and lots of examples, not only from the texts and teachings of Islam, but also from history as well. Of course, that history is reasserting itself now, not only in Israel and Palestine, but also all over Europe.
I don't know if you're familiar with Yosef Bodansky's books. He was an Israeli, but he became the head of some Senate, committee, not obviously as a senator, on terrorism and what's going on in the Middle East. And he documented in a number of books, including one called The High Price of Peace, the fact that the government of Israel essentially acceded to all of Yasser Arafat's demands or requests for return of land, return of control of Jerusalem, and so forth. Something like 99% of the land that they were asking for, the PLO was asking for, Israel agreed to give. But, of course, Yasser Arafat wouldn't accept the peace because, basically, the entire enterprise is a failure as long as Israel exists. As long as Israel exists as a Jewish state in the middle of the, Dar es Islam.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, time after time, Israel has been willing to make concessions, rather big concessions, and time after time, the Palestinians have rejected the concessions and asked for more, which after a while suggests that no concession is going to be enough, that what they really want is the the end of Israel and the extermination of the Jews.
And the fallacy, I didn't mean to get political, I guess I am getting political, but the fallacy of the two-state solution is that the goal for the Palestinians, or for the Arab world, I should say, isn't a separate Palestinian state. It's that once there is a separate Palestinian state embedded in the geography of Israel, which doesn't have any external controls on its armaments or on its military activities, it just becomes a spearhead for destroying Israel, which is the intention.
Well, of course, that's already happened with Gaza. Basically, Israel has pulled out of Gaza a long, long time ago, and the Gazans were free to elect their own government. And in hindsight, it looks like a big mistake because almost immediately after pulling out of Gaza, the Israelis became the target of all these rockets coming over day after day after day, year after year after year. And, of course, it's only when they strike back against these attacks that the rest of the world pays attention. Talks about the killing of innocent civilians in Gaza. So yeah, it's not just a war that's being fought with bullets and bombs. It's also a propaganda war. And unfortunately, it looks like Hamas is winning the propaganda war. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
You said, I shouldn't jump on you, but you said in hindsight, it looks like a mistake that Israel pulled out. But in fact, it is a mistake that Israel pulled out in a sense. But it's not a mistake that Israel made. It's a mistake that the West made, because when Israel pulled out, it didn't do so because it was its first choice. It did so because the international community, read to a large extent the United States, didn't give it a choice.
Well, sure, they've been under tremendous pressure from the West to make these sorts of concessions. And so, you know, against their better interests, really, they've gone along with some of it.
Yeah. I just found out today in preparation for the show, Article 7 of the Hamas Charter, Hamas being, of course, the government that's running Gaza, is, quote, "Hamas has been looking forward to implementing Allah's promise, whatever time it might take. The Prophet Muhammad said, the time of resurrection will not come until Muslims will fight the Jews, until the Jews hide behind rocks and trees, which will cry, 'Oh Muslim, there's a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill him.'" So the Hamas Charter actually quotes this hadith about the day of resurrection won't come until all the Jews are killed.
Right, and the preamble of the charter actually calls for the obliteration of Israel. Some translations use another term, destruction. I'm not sure, but it's quite obvious that this is what Hamas wants. It's written right into their charter, as you say. So,
and this is particularly frightening, you know, to me as a Jew, or at least a Jew in the eyes of Hamas and Islam. But actually a Jew in my own eyes, too, is that Arabic does not have two words, one for Israeli and one for Jew. It's one and the same word. And in the activities of Hamas and Islamic terrorists around the world, there's no distinction made between an Israeli and a Jew. I mean, Leon Klinghoffer on that cruise ship was just as much an enemy as, you know, the head of the IDF in Israel. Because he was a Jew, he was part of the same force.
Sure, and I mean, what's going on now in Europe with all these demonstrations against not only Israel but against the Jews should make it plain to people that Muslims are not going to be, the Islamic world is not going to be satisfied with the Jews leaving Israel. They want Jews to leave the planet, basically, and. Yeah, you know, I don't know if many people are aware of the amount of anti-Semitism, the resurgence of it in Europe. I mean, these recent rallies in almost every major European city involving sometimes attacks on synagogues, Molotov cocktails, attacks on Jewish shops and Jewish homes and Jewish schools, and of course the posters and the chants, death to the Jews, back to the ovens, and so forth and so on. It's more than scary. And the fact that European society, European governments more or less turn a blind eye to this suggests that we have a situation building that's not unsimilar to the anti-Semitism in Europe in the 30s prior to the Nazi takeover of Germany and prior to the Second World War. And in a sense, what's going on now is even worse than what happened back then, because we do have the advantage of hindsight. We know what happened in the past. We know what this anti-Semitism led to. We know the Holocaust that it led to, and you know, we don't have the advantage anymore or the excuse anymore of saying, well, we didn't know. You know, we didn't know it would lead to this. We should know at this point.
The problem in my eyes is what happens kind of when you get behind that pronoun we, because you have two things going on. You have what, you know, well-meaning people are aware of and care about, and then you have the self-serving interests of politicians sometimes, which has nothing to do with that, but simply has to do with their own votes and their own power and so forth. And even if people see what's coming and it's unacceptable, in terms of a, you know, widespread, basically another Holocaust, right by now, the Muslim voting blocs in most of these European countries is far more powerful than the Jewish voting blocs.
Oh, sure. For example, the election of President Hollande of France has been attributed to Muslims voting as a bloc. And of course, he tried to appeal to them by basically calling for more Muslim immigration. That's happening in a lot of places. I mean, when Muslims vote in Europe, they usually vote as a bloc. They're all pretty much on the same page. And many of the European politicians now have begun to cater to them, despite what the man on the street in Europe might want. I mean, I think recent polls are showing that most Europeans now, a majority, are very much opposed to any further immigration. But that message hasn't gotten through to the politicians yet.
If I can say so, even if the message got through the politicians, it's not clear that's the side that their bread would be buttered on, because this is like that. A long time ago, there was a big book written by an MIT professor called, I'm forgetting the title, I shouldn't have started that, something, the Zero Sum Society or something like that. But the idea being everybody who's opposed to immigration is going to be divided on other political issues, and whereas the Muslim bloc will be one. And so...
Exactly.
You know, a large number of people who care about something, you know, as one of several issues, is never as powerful as a smaller group of people who only care about one issue. This incident that I learned about from one of your articles has been on the back of my mind throughout the show, and I would actually like you to kind of invite you to talk about it. I do want to warn our listeners that this has to do with a very sordid situation that took place recently in Great Britain, and it's definitely not GP rated. If you have children listening, you might want to have them skip the next part of the show. But I was really haunted by it because it was a horrible, horrible situation. I think you know what I'm referring to, Kirk, but I'll give a little more of an intro. A kidnapping and rape of young girls had went on for a long time, and the first person who tried to report it, instead of anything being done, and she was a government official, she was sent to sensitivity training.
Exactly.
So, us a synopsis?
That's Rotherham, England, which is an English city of about 250,000 in the Midlands. And it was recently revealed that for more than a decade and a half, 1,400 girls between some as young as 11, most of them teenagers, were the victims of Muslim gangs, Pakistani gangs. They were being groomed and raped and gang raped and traded and sold into prostitution and so forth and so on. And the shocking point is that the authorities knew about it. The city council knew about it. The child protection services knew about it. The press knew about it. The police knew about it, but they didn't do anything about it because they were afraid of charges of Islamophobia and bigotry and racism, because the perpetrators were Pakistanis. And so this went on for a long, long time. And it's not just that one city. It's happening in cities and towns all over England, especially in the Midlands, according to a recent report, at any one time between 10 and 20,000 girls are held as virtual sex slaves by these gangs, and that's in merry old England. And I don't think we realize how far down the path of political correctness and multiculturalism England has gone, but they've gone far enough to the extent that they don't dare speak out about obvious atrocities like this.
And I think, if I remember your article right, about 2 years into this, when only 200 girls have been victimized so far, a worker with Child Protective Services tried to report it and get something done, and she was severely censured and sent to sensitivity training, right?
Well, exactly. And others admitted later, subsequently, that, you know, they knew what was happening, but they were afraid to say. I mean, the report, which was recently done, makes it very plain that there was a link between these atrocities, these rapes, and the multicultural diversity, politically correct atmosphere that prevailed. And in fact, there was another report that came out about a year ago talking about the same general condition in all the Midlands, and it was called Easy Meat, Multiculturalism and Rape in the Midlands, something to that effect. So, you know, I mean, that's the situation that prevails in England and in many other European countries as well. Well, sure, the media is stuck with this narrative that still maintains, despite all the evidence, that Islam is a religion of peace, and all this violent stuff has nothing to do with Islam, and they seem to be prepared to defend that narrative to the death, or to our death.
To our death, yeah. It'll probably stop when it cuts to their death. But
well, I mean, another example is a couple summers ago, Michelle Bachmann and four other members of Congress wrote letters to inspector generals of the State Department and Homeland Security and a few other agencies asking for an investigation into possible Muslim Brotherhood penetration of the government. And they were just, they got nowhere. They were just shot down by their colleagues. They were attacked and criticized not only by the Democrats, but by Republican congressmen as well, who, you know, talked about how insensitive they were being and how offensive to the Muslim community and so forth. So because of this political correctness, we're not really allowed to look at things that we should be looking at. For example, they mentioned Huma Abedin, who was Secretary of State Clinton's Deputy Chief of Staff and top personal aide, and the fact that three members of her family were closely connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, this Huma Abedin. And she herself was involved with the Muslim Brotherhood, that she was managing editor for a Muslim Brotherhood periodical and so forth. Looks like something that maybe you want to investigate, that the person right next to the Secretary of State has these connections. But no, basically these congressmen were shouted down.
We're unfortunately coming to the end of the hour, so I wanted to just invite you to spend the last couple of minutes talking about I don't know how to put this, but if you had the ear of the Catholic Church, if you had the ear of the hierarchy, if you had the ear of the USCCB, you know, what could they do better?
Well, you know, in a sense, they're in the same sort of position as the media and the government. They're stuck with this narrative that says that Islam is basically a religion of peace and that it shares a lot in common with Catholicism. And this goes back to Vatican II Council on the document Nostra Aetate, which has a couple of very brief paragraphs about the Church's relationship with the Muslims. And because the mandate of the document is to look at things that people share in common. They list a few things that Muslims and Catholics share in common, a few very broad, general types of things. And ever since, that's been taken as sort of the final word on Islam, as though there's nothing more to say. And it's been terribly misleading. I think it lulls people into a sense of complacency, and as a result, Catholics and other Christians haven't been prepared for the kinds of things that are happening now in Nigeria and Syria and Iraq and all around the world. So I think, in a sense, bishops and priests and people who are in these bishops' conferences need to wake up and take a closer, harder look at Islam and maybe start giving a fuller story of what's going on. Mm.
I just want to flesh it out that you mentioned Nostra Aetate, and thank goodness Pope Benedict gave a little bit of a corrective to the overly rosy view of Nostra Aetate. And let me just read that. It's from, let me see what the citation is from. It's from Reflections of His Holiness Benedict XVI on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Second Vatican Council. And he said, quote, "A weakness of this otherwise extraordinary text, that is Nostra Aetate, has gradually emerged. It speaks of religion solely in a positive way, and it disregards the sick and distorted forms of religion, which, from the historical and theological viewpoints, are of far-reaching importance. For this reason, the Christian faith from the outset adopted a critical stance toward religion, both internally and externally." And I think we may be seeing, needless to say, some of these sick and distorted forms of religion, which are perhaps being lumped together a little bit too blithely with more benevolent forms of religion.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, a lot of Catholic leaders have adopted this position that all religions are good, that if you're a religion, you're part of the family and we'll defend you and say good things about you. Well,
in the last couple minutes, do you have anything anything that you wished you had a chance to mention?
For Catholics and everyone, really, I think it's time to wake up, because I think we have been lulled into complacency, but sometimes modern Islam moves slowly, and sometimes it can move with surprising speed, and it looks like this is one of those times, and if we don't want to be overtaken by events, we need to get prepared, and the best way to do that is to get informed. And once you've informed yourself, inform your priest and your bishop and whoever you can. But as I say, the first order of business is to get informed, to read up on the subject, and arm yourself with information to counter this narrative that the media keeps pushing on us.
I don't think there's a much better way to start than reading Christianity, Islam, and Atheism by our guest, William Kilpatrick. And let me just also kind of close with a quote from Father Mitch Pacwa that's on the back cover of the book, you know, the host on EWTN. So let me read what he has to say about this book. "Kilpatrick's insights into Western relativism, multiculturalism, and the resultant anti-Christian attitudes form a matrix by which the rot of a crumbling society can be better understood. This book summons Christians to awaken their love for the true Jesus Christ of the gospel, to learn sober truth about Christianity and Islam, and to live their faith courageously in the face of Muslim aggression." That's Father Mitch Pacwa's comments on the book Christianity, Islam, and Atheism. So, you know, that's quite a imprimatur from Father Pacwa. So thank you very, very much, Kirk. I just want to thank you for being on the show.
And well, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Well, and I want to thank our listeners and ask or invite you to join us again next week on Salvation is from the Jews. Bye for now.
You are listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. The program you just heard was a rebroadcast of Salvation is from the Jews with Roy Shoman.